Chapter 17. Out of Egypt. The river had begun to rise before they left Thebes, and a great volume of water was pouring down. 10 men were engaged, in addition to the crew, to take the boats up beyond the rapids. Although assured that there was no danger, the girls declared that they would rather walk along the bank, for the hurry and rush of the mighty flood were certainly trying to the nerves. Jethro and the lads, of course, accompanied them, and sometimes seized the rope and added their weight, when the force of the stream brought the men towing to a standstill. At last the top of the rapids was gained, and they were glad to take their places again in the boat as she floated on the quiet water. So a month passed, sometimes taken along by favorable winds, at others being towed along quiet waters close to the shore, at others battling with the furious rapids. They found that the cataract they had first passed was as nothing to those higher up. Here the whole cargo had to be unloaded and carried up to the top of the rapids, and it needed some 40 men to drag the empty boat through the turmoil of waters. After passing the second cataract, and continuing on some distance, at last they reached Semna, the point to which the boatmen had agreed to take them. This was the furthest boundary to which, at that time, Egyptian power extended. The river here took a great bend to the east, then flowing south and afterwards again west, forming a great loop. This could be avoided by cutting across the desert towards the towns which marked the northern limit of the power of Mero. The traders arriving at Semna generally waited until a sufficient number were gathered together to form a strong caravan for mutual protection against natives inhabiting the desert. For these attacked and plundered parties crossing the desert, unless the parties were so strong and well armed as to be able to set them at defiance. Erecting two tents, Jethro and the party encamped near the river bank. They had not yet settled whether they would cross the desert or continue their journey by water. In consultation with the traders gathered at Semna, Jethro learned that a far shorter road existed from the easternmost point of the bend of the river direct to the sea, as Kigran had told him. There were indeed several large Egyptian towns upon the Red Sea, and from these a flourishing trade was carried on with Mero and Abyssinia. Finding that a flotilla of boats was ready to ascend the river, they made an arrangement with some boatmen for the hire of their craft, to the point where they were to leave the river and again set out on their journey. The difficulties of the journey were very great. After traveling for some 60 miles, they came to rapids more dangerous than any they had passed, and it took the flotilla more than a fortnight passing up them, only 4 or 5 boats being taken up each day by the united labors of the whole of the crews. So far, no signs of the presence of hostile natives had been perceived. The usual precautions, however, had been taken. The cargoes had all been carried up by hand and deposited so as to form a breastwork, and as night closed in, several sentries were placed to guard against surprise. It had been arranged that the men belonging to the boats each day brought up should that night take sentinel duty, and this evening Jethro, his companions, and boatmen were among those on guard. Jethro, Amuba, and Kebron were standing together at one of the angles of the encampment when the former suddenly exclaimed, "There are men or animals moving on that hill opposite. I thought several times I heard the sound of stones being displaced. I certainly heard them then." Then turning around, he raised his voice. "I can hear sounds on the hill. Stand to your arms and prepare to resist an attack." In an instant, the sounds of song and laughter ceased, and each man seized his arms. There was a sharp ringing sound close to Jethro, and stooping, he picked up an arrow which had fallen close to him. "It is an enemy," he shouted. "Draw up close to the breastwork and prepare to receive them. Scatter the fires at once and extinguish those blazing brands. They can see us while they are invisible." As he spoke, a loud and terrible yell rose from the hillside, and a shower of arrows was poured into the encampment. Several men fell, but Jethro's orders were carried out, and the fires promptly extinguished. "Stoop down behind the breastwork," Jethro shouted, "until they are near enough for you to take aim. Have your spears ready to check their onslaught if they charge." Although Jethro held no position entitling him to command, the men recognized at once that he was accustomed to warfare, and they readily yielded to him obedience. In a minute or two, a crowd of figures could be seen approaching, and the Egyptians, leaping to their feet, poured in a volley of arrows. The yells and screams which broke forth testified to the execution wrought in the ranks of the enemy, but without a check they still rushed forward. The Egyptians discharged their arrows as fast as they could during the few moments left them, and then as the natives rushed at the breastwork, they boldly met the foe. For a few minutes the contest was doubtful, but encouraged by the shouts of Jethro, whose voice could be heard above the yells of the natives, the Egyptians defended their position with vigor and courage. As fast as the natives climbed over the low breastwork of merchandise, they were cut down. After 10 minutes' fierce fighting, their attack ceased, as suddenly as it had begun. As if by magic, a dead silence succeeded the din of battle. "We have done well," Jethro said, "but we had best stand to arms for a while, for they may return." As soon as the fighting was over, Cabron ran down to the boat to allay the fears of the girls and assure them that none of their party had received a serious wound.
"Why did not Amuba come down with you?" Mysa asked. "Are you sure he escaped without injury?"
"I can assure you that he has not been touched, Mysa. But we are still on guard, for it is possible that the enemy may return again, although we hope that the lesson has been sufficient for them."
"Were you frightened, Cabron?"
"I felt a little nervous as they were coming on, but I was too excited to think about the danger. Besides, I was standing between Jethro and Amuba, and they have fought in great battles and seemed so quiet and cool that I could scarcely feel otherwise. But now I must get back to my post." When Cabron had left them, Mysa said,
"I have often wondered, Ruth, what we should have done if it had not been for Jethro and Amuba. If it had not been for them, I should have been obliged to marry Plexo, and Cabron would have been caught and killed at Thebes. They arrange everything and do not seem afraid in the slightest."
"I think your brother is brave, too," Ruth said, "and they always consult with him about their plans."
"Yes, but it is all their doing. Cabron, before they came, thought of nothing but reading and was quiet and gentle. Being with Amuba has quite altered him. He can walk and run and shoot an arrow or throw a javelin almost as well as Amuba can. Still, he has not so much spirit. I think Amuba always speaks decidedly, while Cabron hesitates to give an opinion."
"But your brother has a great deal more learning than Amuba, Mysa."
"Oh, yes. But about other things. Of course it's natural that they should be different, because Amuba is the son of a king."
"The son of a king?" Ruth repeated in surprise.
"Yes, I heard it when he first came. He is the son of a king, and as his father is dead, he will be king himself when he gets back to his own country. I think Jethro was one of the king's warriors."
"That accounts for what has often puzzled me," said Ruth.
"Jethro is much the oldest of our party, and altogether the leader, and yet I have observed that he always speaks to Amuba as if the latter were the chief. And you think if he ever gets back to his own country, he will be king?"
"I am not sure," Mysa said doubtfully.
"Of course he ought to be. I suppose there is some other king now, and he might not like to give it up to Amuba."
"Anyway," said Ruth, "I don't suppose we shall ever get there."
An hour later, as nothing had been heard from the enemy, the fires were relighted and the wounded attended to. The next day the journey was continued, and the flotilla arrived at last at the town where the party would leave the river and strike for the coast. Having unloaded their goods and discharged the boat, Jethro hired a small house until arrangements were made for their journey to the seacoast. There were two chiefs claiming jurisdiction over the road, and a messenger was at once dispatched to the nearest of these with the offer of the usual payment and a request for an escort. A week later, four wild-looking figures presented themselves at the house and stated that they were ready to conduct the travelers through their chief's territory. Jethro had already made arrangements for 12 men to carry provisions necessary for the journey, and upon the following morning the party started. Mysa and Ruth assumed the garb of boys.
Jethro finding that although traders might bring the ladies of their family up the river in boats, they would never think of exposing them to a journey across the mountains. And so the arrival of two girls at the Egyptian town on the sea would assuredly attract inquiry on the part of the authorities. For the first few hours, the girls enjoyed the change of traveling after the long confinement on the boat. But long before nightfall, they longed for the snug cushions and easy life they had left behind. The bearers proceeded at a steady pace, and the heat of the sun was intense. They did not suffer from thirst, for an ample supply of fruit was carried by one of the bearers, but their limbs ached, and their feet, unused to walking, became tender and painful.
"Can we not stop for a while, father?"
Mysa asked. Jethro replied, "We must keep on to the wells. They are 2 hours further yet. They told us at starting that the first day's journey was 6 hours, steady walking." Mysa was about to say that she could walk no further, when Ruth whispered into her ear,
"We must not give way, Mysa. You know we promised that if they would take us with them, we would go through all difficulties and dangers without complaining."
The admonition had its effect. Mysa felt ashamed that she had been on the point of giving way on the very first day of their starting on their real journey, and she struggled bravely on. But both girls were utterly exhausted by the time they arrived at the wells. However, they felt rewarded for their sufferings by the hearty commendation Jethro bestowed upon them. "You have held on most bravely, for I could see you were terribly fatigued. Tomorrow's journey is a shorter one." It was well that it was so, for the girls were limping even at the start and needed the assistance of Jethro and the boys to reach the next halting place, and as soon as the tent was erected they dropped upon their cushions. Jethro told their escort that they must halt the next day because his young sons had been so long in the boat that the fatigue had quite overcome them. The day's rest greatly benefited the girls, but it was not long enough to be of any utility to their feet. These, however, they wrapped in bandages, and they started in good spirits when the porters took up the loads. They arrived at the next halting place in much better condition than on the previous occasions. 3 days later they arrived at a small village, which marked the commencement of the territory of the second chief through whose country the road ran. Here the escort and carriers left them, their place being supplied by natives of the village. And after another fortnight's travel, they stood on the lower slopes of the hills and saw across a wide belt of flat country the sea glistening in the sun. 2 more days' journey and they reached the Egyptian trading station. As soon as they entered the town, Jethro was ordered by an official to accompany him to the house of the governor. Taking Kebron with him, he left it to Amuba to arrange for the use of a small house during their stay. Fortunately, the governor's inquiries were limited to the state of the country, the behavior of the tribesmen along the road, the state of the wells, and the amount of provisions obtainable along the line of route. A week's rest completely refreshed the girls, and then Jethro engaged a passage in a trading ship, which was going to touch at various small ports on its way north.